Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we're in conversation with a real horror renaissance woman. Gemma Moore has so many strings to her various bows. She's an illustrator, a voice actor, a fellow podcaster, and a writer for shows like the No Sleep podcast. She's also a Bram Stoker nominated author, and just generally a delightful person. Now, the last time Gemma was on the show, we spent over 90 minutes talking about the inner workings of our fractured psyches. This time around, we do manage to stay a little more on track, covering the coastal eeriness, father-daughter dynamics, and possession horror in her new novel, The Folly. But, this being Gemma, she pulls me hither and thither into the terror of confused identity, the nature of haunted architecture, with or without ghosts, and a rare focus on the trauma of the COVID years. But we do keep it light, believe it or not. Now, if you like what you hear, check out the Patreon channel. You can subscribe, support the show in very important ways, and get tons of bonus content, including both halves now of my candid Ask Me Anything episodes. That contains lots of book thoughts and revelations therein. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod or hit the link in the show notes or on the Talking Scared website. And thanks very much. But now, come with me to an empty stretch of English coastline. There's a tower peeking out of the evening mist, like a finger warning away the unwary. Let's talk scared. Hello, Gemma Moore. Welcome to Talking Scared. Are you well?
Yes, as well as can be expected in the circumstances, I think, of this year, which has been manic.
Yeah, and we're at the tail end of it, and everyone largely can't be arsed, and we have to try and raise our game.
We do. We have to make up for all those days off all those Americans are having.
The Americans
with their bloody holidays that go on for days on end.
Yeah, disgusting. 10 days a year that they always take at the worst possible time. Yeah.
I mean, it's not like we have 9 weeks of the year fully paid or anything.
I know. Socialism gone crazy.
Disgusting state of affairs.
Let's not start on that vein. It's very good to have you back on the show because it's been about a year since you were last on Talking Scared, which, frankly, is usually too soon for a return visit because I normally have other people to speak to. But in your case, it's great and necessary because, one, essentially you're a mate. There's no point hiding that fact. We WhatsApp.
I mean, I wouldn't go that far, Neil. I don't have friends. I don't like anybody. No.
Wounded. But more importantly, this time I've managed to actually read your book.
Yay!
For newbies to the show, last time Gemma joined me, I had to make the terrible admission about 3 days in advance that I couldn't actually read her book at the time, full immersion, because it just disturbed me too much. And to be fair, that's because it tweaked a very particular vein of anxiety that I suffer with. But Gemma, you were very generous, and we went ahead and recorded a whole thing about mental health in horror, which went down very well.
We did, and it was actually quite cathartic for me anyway, so I bore absolutely no hard feelings whatsoever, because, I mean, let's get real, horror is a very triggering genre sometimes, and so there's never going to be an occasion where I sit down and get cross with somebody because they didn't want to engage with what was in the book because they found it, like, traumatizing themselves. I'm not that much of an egotist. I did, of course, badmouth you to everybody after. No, I didn't.
Well, it was no sort of criticism of the book, because I've got friends who aren't even horror fans who loved it.
Sure.
But it was a nice chance to get very vulnerable and kind of expose my broken brain. And I do suggest that anyone who hasn't listened to episode 109 do so ASAP.
Yeah, it was a great chat. And actually, it was something that I very much needed, because Full Immersion was quite a difficult book to write just by nature. It was very autobiographical. And it was nice to have a chance to talk about the things around the book without necessarily having to retell the same story that I'd been talking about nonstop for about a year and a half. So it was a bit of a trauma holiday for me.
Yeah, but that was then, this is now, and you're here to talk about a brand new book, one that I could read, and it's called The Folly. It's out today, December 5th, and basically, would you like to introduce it to the listeners?
Sure. I will just say that I believe it's out on December the 5th in the US. I think if you're in the UK, you're going to have to wait until January. I'm just waiting for my publisher to confirm exactly the date, but because of those pesky Thanksgiving holidays, I don't have an exact date for non-US based readers. But The Folly is a short novel, or perhaps a long novella, somewhere in between the two, which I wrote, interestingly enough, I wrote when I was staying in Colorado in preparation for StokerCon the year before this one, which was just 2022. And I was in an Airbnb in Estes Park, in the beautiful Estes Park, which some listeners may recognize as being the home of the Stanley Hotel, which is the hotel that inspired Stephen King to write The Shining. And I was helping to organize an event there. But in the run-up to that event, I was staying with the lovely cast members of the No Sleep podcast in a very beautiful house in Estes Park, surrounded by mountains. And I was horribly jet-lagged. And I would be getting up at sort of 4 a.m. local time, which was normal writing time for me. And this is the book that came out of that. And why I decided to write a book about Cornwall while I was in the Rockies in America, I don't know. But that's what happened. And in a nutshell, it's the story of an ex-con, a man who was wrongly convicted of the murder of his wife, and his daughter, who has campaigned tirelessly for his release from prison because she believes in his innocence. And he finally is retried and released sort of halfway through his sentence. And he and his daughter decide they need a new start. They need a new life. So they move into a tall sort of lonely structure on the Cornish coastline called The Folly. And for anyone that doesn't know, a folly, it's like an ornamental structure that was built purely for aesthetics and often used to pop up on the large estates of country houses and mansions here. And so they move into this folly as caretakers, because the folly has a bit of a reputation for being, shall we say, a danger spot and a point of interest to the locals. And then things begin to unravel, as you can imagine they would do. It's also worth pointing out that this is set, not only is it sort of isolating in that it's set on the Cornish coastline on a cliff overlooking the sea with this big sort of lonely tower, but it's also set during the pandemic. So there's sort of double helpings of isolation horror for anybody that likes that sort of thing. And there are lots of family secrets and hidden tensions and father-daughter dynamics and all sorts of things that I kind of hopefully managed to explore a little bit in the short page count I gave myself. So I hope that's a worthy introduction.
Yeah, and we'll tease out more as we go along. But I didn't realise you'd written it when you're in Colorado. So did you write it in its entirety then? Did you write this pretty fast?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, it's not a very big book. It didn't take me long, because I think when I know where a story's going and when I have a very firm grasp of characters and the things that I actually want to say and why I'm writing something, it tends to flow pretty fast. And I also had like a good sort of 4 or 5 hour period every morning where I was up. It was quite an inspiring surroundings, mountains and snow and elk wandering around everywhere. And I was surrounded by creative people, and it just came out of me. Some books pour out like hot lava, you know, and other books are just like, you have to squeeze each pebble out bit by bit. This was a hot lava book for me. It was a big word blurt.
Okay. Well, it comes together pretty neatly to say it's a big word blurt. I don't think I could tie something up as elegantly as this if I was just pounding words out. I think it'd be all over the place. It feels like a very intentioned novel with like theme and structure and climax and all of those things. So
lovely. I'm going to pretend that I am an insanely detailed plotter and a planner rather than a chaotic pantser who just word vomits all over the page and hopes the best. I mean, like I said as well, I think one of the lovely things about horror as a genre, and particularly if you're writing something very isolated with a minimal cast and with kind of only a few key things going on, is it's a lot easier to wrap up those plot points, if that makes sense. And it's a lot easier to tie off loose ends than if I was writing a big grand cast true crime procedural thriller or something where, you know, plot is key. This was more of a kind of family drama, I like to say, more of a family drama with horrific elements to it, which, yeah. And also because I suppose like most books I write, there are lots of personal things I'm exploring within the context of the structure of the book. So the resolution, I think, is, without getting too deep, the resolution in the book is generally how I've decided to feel about something if I'm exploring it through my writing. Okay. So it's kind of easy to know where something's going when you know how you feel. But I don't always know how I feel until I've written the book. So that makes absolutely no sense to anybody else but me, but it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, when you read the book, it will make sense. I'm not going to let you off the hook as easy as you tried a minute ago, because you just said, I don't know why I said it in Cornwall when I was in Colorado. So we don't need to talk about the disjunction there between Cornwall and Colorado, but I do want to talk about Cornwall. And firstly, to explain, right, for example, I listen to so many US podcasts that just assume I know where Wyoming is in relation to the Dakotas. You know, it can be hard work. So to be absolutely clear, for those who may not know from overseas, Cornwall is a county of England. It's the most southwestern county, a sort of peninsula that dangles off the bottom corner of the UK. And it's very much a region and culture unto itself. I mean, lots of parts of the UK are, but Cornwall is one of the most inimitable, I suppose.
It is, yeah.
But you're not from Cornwall, I believe.
No, I'm not from the southwest. I'm from the exact opposite. I'm from Norfolk. I'm from the other side of the country. So
the other odd bit of the country.
Well, so for context for listeners, so I grew up in what I suppose you could describe as the Texas of the UK, in a region called Norfolk, and most specifically in the Fens, in the Fenlands. And they come up very heavily in the next novel that I've just finished writing, but we won't go there just yet. But it's a very flat, very agricultural, very muddy, rather bleak, rural to the extreme part of England, that can be very bleak. And if anyone's seen Threads, which I know we talk about a lot, I know Threads, the kind of Cold War drama that's sort of a bit notorious now for how grim and bleak it was. Those are mostly set in the cities, but there are certain scenes in that, and also in the movie Possum, if you've seen that, that kind of mood, mm-hmm. that kind of monochrome landscape, that's very much how I grew up. Cornwall, by contrast, which is in the southwest, and as Neil sort of accurately described, it dangles out. It's like the kicking leg of England. And it's actually quite close to France, and the waters down there are this beautiful azure blue. There's limestone cliffs and granite rocks everywhere. Everybody eats fish. There's lots of tiny little fishing towns. And interestingly, where I grew up, there are lots of tiny little fishing towns too. And I grew up sort of crab fishing and doing all the nautical stuff, boats and all that jazz. But there's a very different flavour to Cornwall, which feels very old and very wild. And it's just a stunningly beautiful place. And it's also where Daphne du Maurier spent lots of time. Mm-hmm. And she set lots of books there. And Rebecca is the famous one. I believe my cousin Rachel is also set on the Cornish coastline. And interestingly, the original iteration of the story, The Birds, is set in a farm, I believe, on the Cornish cliffs, which very much inspired me to sort of take this folly structure that I had in mind would be a perfect setting for a book, and kind of in an imaginary way transpose it and plop it onto these lovely Cornish rocks. So the other thing about the area is that it's also absolutely chock full of history and ancient history as well. So there are burial mounds and cairns and Celtic cross markers in the roads, and it's such an unusual place. It doesn't feel like the rest of the country at all. It always feels to me like a country all of its own. But I also know that, as idyllic as that sounds, nowhere in England is really that idyllic, and it has a lot of problems. It's difficult to find employment. It's cultural. There are issues with things like drugs and party culture and tourists buying up all the local houses. And so there's lots of different factors that come into play and just make it a very, I think, closed off, unique region to set these kind of stories. And it won't be the last time I write a novel set in Cornwall, because I'm just mesmerised by the place, which I'm sure if you're local to Cornwall, I'm sorry, I know a lot of you are bored with us tourists coming down and eulogising all over it, but it's a stunning region and I absolutely adore it. And I go there maybe two or three or four times a year with my family, and do lots of walking. There's lots of coastal paths that you can hike along. and lots of fish and chips to be eaten, and, you know, old fisherman pubs that you can sit in. And to me, it's quite a mystical place.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to tap into that energy. And I think actually, maybe I answered my own question with why I was writing about Cornwall while I was in Colorado. Both of them felt like very magical, mystical, kind of foreign places to me. But in their own right, I wonder whether they were sort of feeding off each other in my head as I was exploring one and thinking of the other, and how they made me feel sort of simultaneously.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And I think it's quite interesting that you come from Norfolk and you wrote this book in Cornwall, because they're two of the only counties in the UK that don't have motorways in them.
That's true, yeah.
But I think that's important, yeah. Because so for overseas listeners, that's the equivalent of a state not having a highway or an interstate in it. You know, there are no big roads that get you from A to B quickly in these quite large regions. And it allows Cornwall and Norfolk to feel isolated in a way that other places that are in many ways more sparsely populated,
sure,
don't feel. The Lake District, for example, up near me in the north, is mountainous, it's huge rural expanses, but it's quite well connected inside it. So yeah, you never feel as cut off as you do when you go to Cornwall, where there are actually more people and more villages, but you feel way more cut off. So it's right. one of the true residually gothic landscapes of the UK, I think.
It is, except I have noticed things are definitely changing in Cornwall. So because of COVID and because of lockdown, it was always a fairly popular summer destination for British people to drive to. And there is a kind of recurring joke that on Easter holidays and summer holidays, you can't move down there for mm-hmm. London tourists and people from all over the world. And actually, that can be, there are towns like St. Ives, which you can't move, you're shoulder to shoulder with people in the summer. So the times I tend to go there are the shoulder seasons, or when the weather's not, you know, sort of sunny and hot, so that I can experience that loneliness, because we are a small country and there are quite a lot of us, and we do tend to cram to all the same places. And so I wanted to almost reset that a little bit with The Folly, and that's why I think I set it during the pandemic as well, because that loneliness I think has been lost lately. And I sort of mentioned before people buying up houses and turning them into long-term Airbnb lets or holiday homes, and there's a lot of that going on over here because we were encouraged for a while also to not fly overseas and to holiday in England. And so the dichotomy between this the bustling seaside holiday towns versus the lonely wild coast with the seagulls, you know, crying overhead in bleak sort of sad tone, you know, that's something that I struggle with, and perhaps have again romanticized a little in The Folly. So the character in The Folly, the characters Morgan and her father, they move from Bristol and they move to Cornwall. And there was very much a sense for Morgan of her character getting fed up with the city, getting fed up with not being able to sort of move for people and the constant noise and the sensory overload, and moving down to Cornwall to get away. And I think that probably represents how I feel on a day-to-day basis, just in general, just in life. So I will always end up romanticizing these places, I think, because it's escapism for me as well as it is for the reader.
Yeah, and it is a question that there may be nothing in this, or there may be something, I don't know. But why did you have them relocate to a folly rather than a lighthouse, or, you know, a coastal cottage, or all these things that litter that part of
sure.
the world? Is there a thematic thing there?
Well, on? I mean, lighthouses have been very well used. I think that's the first thing to say. And nobody's ever really going to do the lighthouse better than Jeff Vandermeer with Annihilation and the lighthouse in Area X.
I will argue with you that the best lighthouse book I've ever read is Emma Stonex's The Lamplighters.
Okay, well, I haven't read that yet, actually. That's on my list. But growing up in Norfolk, there are lots of lighthouses, some of them functional, some of them not. Most of them have been turned into accommodation and housing, or hotels or Airbnbs. Some of them still work. And also down in Cornwall, there are some still functional lighthouses. Down at Land's End, there's a particularly loud one because there's a lot of sea fog. which has a kind of blaring siren that goes out. So there's always been this mystique around lighthouses. But I wanted to do something ever so slightly different. And the reason I chose, I wanted something monumental like a lighthouse that was near the sea, because mm-hmm. that was very important to me. But I didn't want the tower itself to have a functional purpose. And right. by that, I mean a folly, like I said before. So a folly, for anybody who doesn't know what folly architecture is a standalone kind of frivolous piece of architecture that serves no purpose whatsoever other than kind of purely aesthetic, to sort of stand there and to enhance the natural landscape. And it was all the rage when people had shitloads of money and lived in massive mansions and owned all the land. And they just thought, you know, here's a lovely rolling hillside. I'm going to build a monument to myself, stick it on the landscape and consider that an enhancement. And the word folly itself comes from the French, which is folie. And again, sort of means pretty and frivolous. And I don't know if you've ever heard the expression folie à deux.
Yeah, madness of two.
The madness of two. There was a very distinct reason I wanted a folly tower. And it was symbolism, first and foremost, because I wanted the tower to represent the shared psychosis and madness that Morgan and her father kind of descend into, because I believe very much in buildings and structures representing a mental state of mind, which I've done in other books. I did that with Six Rooms and the Sunshire Chateau. But I also wanted this building to have no purpose and to be essentially vacuous and empty and kind of meaningless, a little bit, without going too deep, a little bit like life, like having no meaning ascribed to it whatsoever. And lighthouses for me, they're brilliant, dramatic structures, but they're very purposeful. They have a purpose, even when they're not being used for that. Whereas folly towers are ultimately deceitful, I think, structures by nature.
There's a folly on the hill above my house, quite a famous one. I'll put a photo on social media. It's called Peel Tower. It was a sort of memorial tower to Robert Peel, the 1800s right, Prime yeah. Minister. When I'm out running in the winter, there's sometimes a light on in the top of it. They must be cleaning it. Like it's close to the public. And it's a kind of castellated right. sort of single plinth tower. And when I go running, I always see a light on the top. And I have this recurring story that's fermenting that I don't know why, but it's a wizard that's up there.
Love it.
And there's something about follies, right? And again, it's the fact that they're purposeless. So it's like there's something already odd about the expenditure and the labour and just the yeah. sheer existence is just an odd thing to begin with. So uncanny things have to happen in them.
Right. It's so interesting, isn't it, as well? Because that era in kind of British history when the wealthy were very wealthy and they had nothing better to do than to just build frivolous, extraneous structures that dotted the landscape that we now look at and go, oh, that's so pretty. Yeah. Look at that. That's, you know, it's such a cool setting. But the very nature of like wasting that much money on what is essentially a kind of bricks and mortar ego trip.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, in this day and age, when we do it now, when the big tech bros send a rocket up into space or you know, whatever, they build these big towers that are a penis replacement structure.
Yeah.
It's like we're very much frowned upon. But in those days, it was all de rigueur and you were contributing something to the English landscape and the Garden of England and whatever. So I really liked the deceitful nature of the folly tower. And I think it very much echoed the theme of the book, which is that all is not as it seems. Or perhaps it is. There's an emptiness.
Yes, because that goes back to the very, very roots of horror fiction. So the first ever gothic novel, which spawned everything after it, The Castle of Otranto in like the 1760s, and that was built by written by Horace Walpole, who built a house just outside London called Strawberry Hill, built to look like a fake gothic mansion. So yeah. 250 years ago, it was already fakery. And now we've attributed all this history to it. And it's like layers and layers of counterfeiting.
Well, there was a grand tradition in England, again, for anybody that doesn't know, with Gothic architecture, to recreate houses that were then kind of made fun of in things like Bleak House. But it was there's a house just on the outskirts of Bristol called Tintersfield, which is the most gloriously Gothic mansion you've ever seen. It's got all the frills and the carved gargoyles and the, you know, crenellated rooftops and stained glass windows and Gothic archways. And it's a phenomenal building. But it was built in that style because it was trendy. It was a trend. And again, that's another one that I'll come back to. And I sort of referred to it on and off in Six Rooms again. But the owners of that house made their money through harvesting penguin shit and bird shit, which was guano, and they sold it as compost and fertilizer. And they were one of the first people to industrialize shit as fertilizer. And the fact that they built this palatial, beautiful stained glass lit building from the proceeds of bird shit, I think, was a lovely dichotomy in my head. And so again, that brings me back to sort of the functionality and the roots of a structure versus the kind of truths that lie at its root. Mm. And I think that's something that I tried to explore as well with The Folly in this novel, is what is something built upon? What are the foundations that something's built upon, whether it's a building, a structure, or a relationship, and particularly a father-daughter relationship. And this one is built on shaky ground. It looks rock solid from the outside, but the more you investigate structurally, the more weaknesses you discover. And I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by surface versus what's underneath.
Uh-huh. Wasn't Cat Ward's Raw Blood about a dynasty founded on guano?
Oh, I don't know.
I may be wrong about that. I'm sure in that book, which is another gothic novel, I'm sure it's a guano industry that they've made their money in. Maybe I'm wrong, but here's a perfect segue. Raw Blood is also a book about fathers and daughters. And, you know, it's almost like I planned this stuff. And that's, in your book, in The Folly, that relationship, that central pairing, is one of the most interesting and uncomfortable parts of the book. You know, because it's a kind of, well, she's not middle-aged, but she is an older daughter. I think, is she just 40 in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I would say she's probably verging on middle age. She's in her 40s.
I've just turned 40, Gemma, tread carefully. Prime of life. She's 40 and her father is older and he's ailing for various reasons. And, you know, we'll get to the pandemic in a moment. That sudden reshifting into caregiving rather than caretaking represented a reality for a lot of people in the pandemic, you know, those new caring roles. But it seems to me, and I may just be reading the wrong books, but it seems to me that is unusual or quite a rare dynamic to write about a grown daughter and her elderly, but not elderly father. They're both in weird positions in their lives in relation to each other. And when we do read about that, it's rarely ever a simple, positive relationship. And, you know, why did you choose that pairing, I suppose?
I'd say for a number of reasons. Number one, I think, as you've sort of pointed out, the majority of things that I watch and read where there is a daddy-daughter relationship focus very much on the child being a child and the dad being a kind of an adult. And I actually think the dynamics become a lot more interesting when you're both adults, because as you say, caregiver roles switch and change and chop. But also there is something in the notion of a parent being taken off of a pedestal, which doesn't tend to happen when you're a wide-eyed innocent child, or in cases it can, which are also very sad. But I wanted to explore, and I have to be careful here, partly for personal reasons, which I probably won't delve into explicitly, but for personal reasons, I wanted to explore a little bit more this idea of what happens when the parent that you have sort of idolized throughout most of your adult life, as well as your childhood, suddenly slips and falls off a pedestal. But there's also this notion, so with Morgan, her father is accused of murdering her mother, and there's never been a moment's doubt in Morgan's eyes that her father didn't do it. She's always presumed his innocence right from the word go. And so it isn't really until his subsequent release from prison, and then they start living together in this very intense, almost like a secondary prison-like environment, that she starts to question not only him, but her own sense of judgment and ability to understand people. And she's sort of questioning everything about herself at a point in our lives where many of us do, I think, that, you know, there's a midlife crisis for a reason. You know, you have all these preconceived notions about your relationships and the dynamics you have with other people, and it doesn't take much to turn them on their head. And you tend to see this explored in fiction when an elderly parent gets ill. So that's not a new theme for horror. Dementia and Alzheimer's is often sort of demonized as the monster. But what if somebody is fully in control of their own cognitive functions, but is just actually a morally gray character, and you're only beginning to see that now or understand that now? And I just was fascinated by the idea of these two adults rediscovering themselves in a different setting. Because families are very tense and toxic as well. By nature, they can be. Anybody that sort of goes through the Christmas holidays, you know, you go into it excited to see everybody and you come out utterly exhausted mm-hmm. by the family dynamics. And sometimes you also can't escape yourself as a child in those dynamics, even if you are in your 40s. And there's many occasions in this novel where Morgan tries to sort of adopt the adult role, but slips back into being a child as well without really knowing she's doing it. So there's lots going on there, but I think I wanted to explore it partly for personal reasons. I won't go into huge details, but what I will say is that my father wasn't present throughout my life. He left when I was a baby, and I met him for the first time when I was 17. And then we sort of kept in contact for a little bit, and now I would say that we're perhaps not in contact. But that's definitely been a factor. Most of the things I write, I'm trying to explore something personal and trying to figure out, like I said before, how I feel about it. It was interesting because my husband read this book, and he sort of put it down, and he had a bit of a look of consternation on his face this time. And he's bearing in mind he's read Full Immersion and he's read, you know, everything else. He's seen how raw and personal I can get, but he sort of finished this book and looked at me and he said, "You have no idea how you feel about any of this, do you?" I was like, "Probably not, no." So I don't know whether I need to write another couple of books to figure this shit out. But yeah, family relationships and dynamics and parental roles are very complicated. And I think without mining my own trauma, I think perhaps I am exploring some things that I perhaps don't fully understand yet myself, if that answers the question.
It does answer, yeah, completely answers the question. And I'm in a similar boat, and I'm not going to sort of say too much because, you know, on occasion my parents listen to this podcast. But it is that weird thing when the thing you said right at the start of your answer about when a parent comes off a pedestal.
Mm.
And it doesn't even have to be through any egregious wrong. It's sometimes just the recognition that they are human and fallible.
Right.
And the dawning horror of realizing it as you get older, that they never had a clue, and right. they never knew more than you know now.
And also, you know, that you end up becoming your parents no matter how hard you try not to. Even if they're good people, you always end up assimilating them into you and becoming them, I think.
Mm-hmm. I just am a clone of my father, like, for better or worse. We have the same personality.
Right.
We have the same
It's almost inescapable. You know? Like, yeah. And it's not just genetics, is it? There's something inherent in our nature which leads us back to the older versions of our parents as we get older ourselves.
Yeah.
Which I, again, is quite, like you said, it's quite horrifying to know that there's an inevitability into, like, turning into your own mom or turning into your own dad. And there are definitely parts of me that I worry about that a lot, and it scares me. So again, I wanted to sort of explore that fear in this book.
Well, I'm going to leap ahead to, this is a question I was going to ask later on, but this seems a good point to ask it in terms of the chronology of this interview, if not the chronology of the book, if that sure. makes sense. So listeners, you may have to assemble sense from this as you listen with what you're going to hear later in the conversation, but it will all make sense eventually. But there were lots of things about this book I liked, lots of things. But the thing that really impressed me from a kind of literary perspective, I suppose, rather than a storytelling or anything else perspective, is the final few pages. They're full of revelations, and we won't go into those because it would spoil the book. But what we can talk about, I think, from a technique point of view, is how you end the book with this almost complete collapse of identities. Yeah. So there's Morgan, there's her father, there's her mother who is dead, but certainly playing a role in the book. There are other participants, shall we say. And in those final pages, you bring their words and their thoughts and their perspectives all together in this kind of dizzying brew. And Morgan even remarks at one point, "Was this the stranger speaking now, or was it me?"
Right.
And considering what you just said about how we become our parents and there's those slippages of who we are and who they are and stuff like that, all of that collapsing of self at the end felt very, very thematic.
Sure, yeah. Yes, absolutely. And
ensue question. I don't have anything more to say about that.
No, well, this is it. And so I think it's interesting. So one of the recurring themes of my books that some people like and some people don't is the ambiguity of my endings. Full Immersion was another one which had a very ambiguous ending that some people got rather cross at. And I think it's because, again, I've never really fully figured out how I feel about something, so I like to leave things open-ended. But B, there's something rather... like you say, there was for me with The Folly, there was a very deliberate sense of I didn't want to lead the reader down any one particular path. So I wanted to present several options for what could have happened and sort of let them make their own mind up. Because for me, that kind of horror is almost more powerful than everything being sort of hand-fed or spoon-fed directly to you. And that's not to say that I haven't written stuff which has been extremely obvious, where I've kind of beaten you around the head with it because I felt it was necessary. But for something like this, and again, because of the complexity of adult relationships with each other and then the complex nature of love and duty and loyalty and hate and guilt and all these things, it felt wrong to have everything tied up in a neat little bow. And so I love the idea, like you say, that collapse of self is exactly what happens. But perhaps through, here we are, we'll get deep now, perhaps through collapsing in on yourself like a dying black star, you can rebirth as something else. It's only when you sort of die that you are reborn, right? So that there's something in, like, we get to the end of the book and we can try and have a guess at what Morgan's future and what the rest of her life is going to look like now, given the events that have transpired before. Or have they? Who knows? It's all a mystery.
Well, yeah, and the question of whether or not it can be read as a delusion or an outright supernatural haunting, which we haven't even got to yet, right. You know, that's too trite a question. And already I know the answer will be that it's for the reader to discover, you know, and stuff like that. Sure. But slightly left field question off the back of that. All the way through, you know, we've got the Cornwall setting, we've got Du Maurier, we've got all of that stuff. But the writer that I kept thinking of was Edgar Allan Poe.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm all right with that.
Well, the reason being is it's a story driven by guilt and neurosis.
Absolutely. It's a very big beating heart under the floorboard, just in a big tower.
Exactly that. Yeah, that's even the story I was thinking of. You know, the heart.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong at all in picking up on that. That was a huge influence for me.
That's good. But and your characters are, you know, truly haunted by both themselves and something exterior.
Yeah.
And this is something I've asked a lot of authors recently. Must be a theme, maybe. Whether or not it is these people who are haunted, or whether The Folly is cursed or haunted itself, because it has a disturbing history of suicide and things like that. So is it somewhere that Morgan and her father have brought the ghosts, or is it a Overlook-style generator for ghosts?
I mean, again, I think that's definitely something that the reader has to decide for themselves, because I think answering that question might sort of spoil some of the fun of the book. But I can say that when I write anything that's location specific, so Six Rooms with the Sunshine Chateau, White Pines with the Greenyard Island, and with the Cottage Taifare, I think that's the correct Gaelic pronunciation. Even Dear Laura with the New Forest. I tend to write things that are in a single setting, and I tend to put a huge amount of weight and significance on those settings as being characters themselves in the book, basically, because I don't believe in ghosts. I don't believe in the supernatural in the sense of, you know, spirits haunting us and the ghosts of people that have passed, kind of, you know, I don't believe in that side of things. But what I do believe in is that you can bring your own ghosts with you, and it can infuse a house or an environment or a setting with something that wasn't there before because of that. And so what's really interesting is I've traveled quite a lot. I've been lucky enough to travel sort of all over the world. And I've been to a couple of places where, because I knew the history of those places, I went in a very different state to how I normally go into a house or a castle or a museum or whatever. And there was one place in particular where I, having never believed in ghosts, this was the first place I ever went into where I thought, this place is fucking haunted. And it was like a gut punch when I walked into a particular room. So I just felt something layered and heavy and something more. And what's fascinating is, so this is a big segue, but I promise it comes back on point. I have a group of girls who live in and around Bristol who are all women in horror, women in the genre. And we meet up every now and then. We just had one this weekend and we have a good margarita and chinwag session and we all write the world's wrongs. And there is one of the girls who's part of that group is a lady called Gemma Hurley, who you may have, you may know her from, she co-wrote Host, the kind of hit movie, and yeah. Dashcam. And she's a wonderful screenwriter. And long story short, we were all sat around the pub having a big old gossip. And I went to the bathroom and I came back and I heard her talking about a place. And she described the feeling that I had down to like the most precise details. And she said, I walked into this room and I felt this presence and I saw this stain on the floor. And I said, you're talking about the prison in Cambodia, aren't you? And she said, yeah. And I believe you pronounce it Tuol Sleng or Tuol Seng. And it was a school in Phnom Penh, I think, which was turned into a prison camp for the Khmer Rouge. And a lot of atrocities were carried out there. And she was talking about the exact same building and the exact same room that I had walked into. And I couldn't believe it because the way she described it was so perfectly how I felt. And obviously what had happened is that we both knew the context of what had happened in those places. And we'd walked into that building and into that place. And then obviously if you see a large rusty brown stain on the floor, you know, and you know what it is historically, your mind goes into this extra layer, I think, of sensitivity to what has taken place and transpired within those walls. And I don't think it's a mistake that many haunted house novels have all got a play on the title, you know, within these walls or whatever, because what happens within a place or within a structure or within a tower can stay, and I don't mean necessarily in a supernatural way, but it stays and it lingers on in the memories and the minds of others, and it becomes lore and it becomes local history and it becomes context. And so I believe in haunted structures very much in that sense, and I'm fascinated by that energy. It's something that I am much more and more sensitive to as I travel and explore now. And so I wanted the Folly Tower itself in this novel to have a history which made you question what was going on within it. Is it just a tragic history and is that separate to what then happens in the Folly in this novel? Or are they part and parcel of the same problem? And it's something I think that perhaps Flanagan's tried to explore with his haunting series, you know, houses having that significance, and that he's very overtly supernatural. I don't like to be quite so open about it. I like to, as I said, let the readers kind of make up their minds. But I think there are multiple ways you can interpret the Folly Tower in this novel. And the only thing I will say to sort of shed light further is to just go back to the word the Folly itself and how important that is to the book, to the characters, to the tower itself, to everything that happens within it. Yeah, that was a very roundabout way of not really answering you.
Gemma, all the best answers are the ones that take segues into personal ghost stories, so I'm fine with that. But I'm not sure that I've even used the right word with haunting, because, well, I mean, it's funny, actually, because I said that your last book tweaked my specific nerve, but, you know, the Folly is actually sort of a possession narrative, which is another oft-mentioned vulnerability of mine. I don't often read possession narratives because they freak me out. But so reading this one, I was like, I thought, Christ, I can't not read another one. I was like, right, time to think about it. So I was really thinking about how you render possession. The trope is normally that someone we know and love starts behaving like a stranger. That's normally the, you know, the horror of possession. Your loved ones are other. You've written a book in which a stranger starts behaving like someone that the characters know and love.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt very intentional inversion.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what's creepier than a complete stranger who thinks that they know you? You know,
mm-hmm.
that there is nothing creepier than that to me. And perhaps it's because I've experienced a little bit of hoo-ha with online behavior from people that feel like they have access to you and understand who you are and know you when they actually don't. They know a kind of social media facsimile of you. But the idea of a familiar stranger in the same hand as Uncanny Valley, which I know goes back to what we sort of spoke about with full immersion, but there's something that's familiar, but is also warped and mm-hmm. not, and it's subverted and inverted. I just sort of sat down and thought, how weird would it be if you were sitting in a cafe one day or just going about your business and a complete stranger comes up to you and starts talking to you with some intimate knowledge of your life or behaves as if they know you? Or do you know what I mean? And I think there's another book or a movie that was a good version of this, which was the story of Amber Rose. And I think the movie had Anthony Hopkins in, but I may have to go and double check that. And it's about I believe it's about a little girl who dies, who then sort of comes back in the body of another little girl. And this man becomes more and more convinced that this little girl is in fact his own daughter. And there are lots of similarities in how she behaves and how she holds herself and the things that she knows and how she acts and moves around the world. And I find that such a chilling concept, you know, particularly when somebody has passed on. People never really pass on, do they? Because they stay on in the memories of others. And so you can almost resurrect somebody by mimicking their voice, by mimicking their individual kind of behavioral tics, by dressing the same way as them, by with the same diction and speech and accent and intonation. And there's all these ways of kind of bringing somebody back to life in a kind of subtle way, what I find quite horrifying. And I think in particular now with the age of AI and, you know, bringing back the dead onto screen and sort of recreating them in a very soulless robotic way, I think I'm very moved by this idea that somebody never really ever dies, even once their physical body has gone. All of their habits and their traits linger. Yeah. And so I wanted to explore that. And really, possession to me means two things in this book. Morgan herself is treated as a possession by various different people throughout the book. But also, what does it mean to possess and to hold somebody else within yourself without getting... it's so difficult to go into detail because I don't want to spoil the book.
No, I know.
But yes, this idea that you yourself can possess somebody else simply by kind of holding them in your heart and then becoming them, dressing the same or acting the same. That all sounds very wishy-washy, but I know what I mean.
No, yeah, and that's what I mean about that at the end. That collapsing of identity feels really thematic because it's about that, isn't it? Who's possessing who? Are you possessing somebody by keeping them even after their death? You're keeping some residue of them alive in yourself, but at the same time that dead person is on a more supernatural level possessing someone else. And
right,
you know, that it's that weird, it's like a really mad Venn diagram, this
yeah.
book.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I like that. Good. I wanted it to be circular, if that makes sense. I wanted it to kind of come back in on itself and go round and round and round. And hopefully I've done that because, again, the tower itself is a circular structure without getting too deep. It's that idea of something being linear, being a beginning, a middle, and end. It's never really appealed to me as a writer. But if you're left with questions, if your brain's going round and round on a topic and you can't quite settle on something after you've read a book, I consider that a job well done. And I know a lot of readers hate it and they get really cross with me. But I think that if you're left with huge amounts of questions, then I've done my job well as a writer.
Mm.
With this topic and with these characters, I just wanted it to be as ambiguous and grey and foggy as possible, like the weather on the Cornish coastline.
Yeah, no, and that might sound like a bit of a flippant thing, but that's actually true, because a lot of Du Maurier stuff is similarly odd, isn't it? You know, like even Rebecca, which has a fairly boilerplate plot, I mean, it's Bluebeard, even that has like these weird dangling moments of oddness and ambiguity and stuff. So I think there is something particularly maybe Cornish about that. I don't know. I'm not enough of an expert to say, but I take the pathetic fallacy and I think it works in this case. To finish, I want to talk about COVID.
Yeah.
Because it's a very COVID novel. And all the stuff we said at the start about Cornwall being both isolated and not isolated, and a tourist destination, but when the tourists aren't there, it's very empty. You know, all of that stuff make it quite a unique stage for COVID. And I haven't talked about the pandemic on the show for a while, because when I started this, we were in the furnace of it.
Yeah.
And then I was trying to give listeners a break from it, essentially. And but now we can perhaps reflect a little more. And well, to start with, is this book part of your processing of the pandemic, I suppose?
Oh, 100%. And so it's really interesting. Just before we hopped on this session, I saw a tweet and I requoted it. And it was a woman saying, you know, I feel like we don't talk about COVID or the pandemic anymore. And I feel like I'm going insane because this enormous world event happened and it's just been already, we've just moved on. But, you know, hundreds of thousands of people died, our entire way of life changed, everything changed for a sizable chunk of the population. And, you know, without getting into the politics of mask wearing or this or that or whatever you believe, the pandemic literally turned our entire worlds upside down for a sizable chunk of time. The two things I always feel when I hear myself say that are, imagine what it was like living through World War II and you had uncertainty and death around you for 6 or 7 years straight, with added bombs, you know, if you lived in England. But also how quick we are to try and move on and forget painful, traumatic things to the point where we just almost blank them out from our memories. And I think that's a large part of why we don't learn lessons as well with certain things. But for me personally, the pandemic, I know a lot of people really enjoyed the isolation. They got loads of work done. They were quite happy staying in and staying indoors. But again, for our American listeners or for anyone who wasn't in the UK during the pandemic, we had several long and quite strict and protracted lockdowns where we weren't allowed to leave the house. Or we were allowed out once a day for an hour for our daily sanctioned walk and our exercise. You know, it was a very weird, very surreal time. And travel was not permitted unless it was for certain circumstances. You know, you couldn't get a haircut. You couldn't go to the dentist. Doctor's appointments were impossible to get. Like, people were fighting over toilet roll in the supermarkets to begin with. We ran out of flour, I think, at one point. It was all these just weird, uncomfortable things, which in and of themselves aren't too bad. But then when you apply the context of everything felt dangerous because everybody was dying, the government were handling communications very poorly and giving lots of mixed messages. There was a big environment of fear, which was exacerbated, I think, by the fact that we were all on social media every day, every hour of every day, because we had nothing else to do. And so on top of that, I was sequestered in my house with my child, who I didn't realize at the time was both dyslexic and ADHD. And he's since been diagnosed with both officially. But we were trying to homeschool a special needs child who was about 5 or 6. And it was horrendous. It was such a traumatic experience for all of us as a family, because we couldn't meet his needs properly. He didn't know how to communicate his needs to us because he didn't know either. So everything was very fraught and very stressful and very dangerous. And then again, for me personally, my grandmother was in a care home and she caught COVID, and then shortly after she passed away. And this was very painful for many reasons, but my grandmother kind of raised me. My mum was a single mum, as we've touched on. And my grandmother with my grandpa were very close by, and they sort of all raised me as a family unit together. And she was a huge part of my life. And there's an enormous amount of trauma that I'm yet to try and process around never being able to say goodbye to somebody until it's, you know, until she's gone. And I think to bring it back to the folly, that sort of happens with Morgan and her mother. You know, she doesn't get a chance to say goodbye. Everything happens so abruptly. So I found the pandemic a very traumatic time, very stifling. My personal freedom and independence was taken away. And again, I think I was exploring that in the folly with this idea of imprisonment. I felt very trapped in my house. You know, walking was monitored, buying food was monitored. The basic acts of everyday self-care were monitored in this kind of Orwellian fashion almost. And then you also got the sense that when you were out, people were kind of giving you the side eye, and what were your motivations for being where you are? Are you allowed to be doing this? And just the general shutdown of the city that I live in, which is the most bustling thing that, you know, normally, and everything was just so surreal and subverted and odd. And I think it would take me a long, long time to process all of that. And I know everybody's mileage varies, and everybody's individual experiences with the pandemic were very different. Some people's lives weren't changed that much. Some people's lives were changed dramatically. But for me, it was a huge event. It was almost cataclysmic in how it changed everything. And I'm still yet to kind of figure out how I feel about any of it. So I guess I've just got to keep writing books. But it's wild to me how, as this lady pointed out on Twitter, there are so few movies about it and so few books about it, because we just don't want to think about it because it was so grim, you know? Yeah. But we're okay, like, let's do another World War II drama. That's fine. Well,
I remember in the pandemic people saying that there was an almost absolute absence of storytelling in the wake of the Spanish flu.
Right.
That it was just that culture just kind of brushed under the carpet and act like it didn't happen. Whereas the war, obviously, is the most fertile soil for storytelling. And I wonder if it's simply impotence, whether, you know, writing about the trauma of war is an active thing with a protagonist and an antagonist.
It's easy to know who the enemy is when it's hit
and
there,
you can beat the enemy, right? You can beat it. It might be fantasy, like Tarantino's version, but you can beat the enemy. Whereas a great pandemic or something like that, it sounds awful to say, but it's a very mundane crisis.
It sort of is and it isn't. But what I found fascinating, and again, without getting too heavy, is how human nature kind of bifurcated during the pandemic. And you saw the best of people and you saw the fucking worst of people as well. And, you know, without putting too fine a point upon it, I will never vote Conservative. I never did. But if I was ever in any minor doubt ever throughout my life, the pandemic put paid to the motivations of the Conservative Party, who effectively, and without being too dramatic, murdered my grandmother with a lot of their policies surrounding healthcare during COVID and how patients were allowed to be discharged from hospitals and put back into care homes without COVID tests. And they were very open about the fact that it was a bit of an experiment. Mm. You know, there was a phrase that was bandied around, herd immunity. And what that essentially meant was that kind of it was okay to let the weakest in our society die for the greater good of the population, to let the germs circulate so that we all got slowly healthier. And I don't think I will ever get over the just insane levels of everyday cruelty that I witnessed on the television or on social media, or just selfishness and cruelty that came out of the pandemic, but also some incredible people doing incredible things and funding research and going the extra mile to feed people and to make other people's lives comfortable in these terrible times. And I think what these world events do is they bring out what human nature actually is, and which can be a wonderful, awful, and very complicated thing. Yeah. And again, it's something that in relationships you learn more as you get older, that nothing is black and white, that nothing is simple. There is no good or bad. It's everyone has their own personal motivations for survival that make them behave in certain ways that you can subsequently rationalize, right? even if from an outside perspective, what that person's doing is so clearly wrong. Everything is very nuanced, but it sort of traumatized me. I won't lie. Like it, I still have a problem unpacking or even knowing where to start with all of it. And I know people say you shouldn't dwell on the past and it's done now and we're all moving on, but like, how do you move on? How? Right. It's with therapy, with whatever, with writing books. But just what a staggeringly wild and weird. And that whole pandemic started for me as well. In January 2020, I was on tour with the No Sleep podcast. We were performing scripts and one of the scripts was mine. And in middle of January or the end of January, I was in the Hotel Rival, which has got a theater. There was 750 people seated to watch a live show performance from the podcast, including a script of mine, which was one of the wildest and most incredible nights of my life. And then I went home and then I went into lockdown. Yeah. It's just like, what is happening? You know, like, and I still struggle to process it on a daily basis. Yeah.
Well, I know it is hard to move on, Gemma, but in podcast terms, I'm going to, otherwise we'll end up rehashing the pandemic and getting really depressed and furious at the government and no one
needs to
hear that.
We can go to the pub and do that later.
Indeed, yeah. I will say this is a great book to, it's a bit of a trip down memory lane of COVID-19 and COVID-20 and COVID-21 or whatever, but without having to dwell too much on the actual symptoms and the horror of the disease itself. So
sure, it's a backdrop, but it's something that's kind of prevalent, but it isn't the main thrust of the narrative, if that helps. Yeah. Anybody who doesn't want to read a COVID book, it's not really a COVID book, but it sort of is.
This is usually the point where I ask for book recommendations, but first, can I ask about your forthcoming anthology, Roots of My Fears, because I'm very intrigued by the premise.
Sure. So it's an anthology that I am editing for Titan Books, who have got their fingers in lots of horror pies these days and pretty much publish every major horror author going in the UK. And they actually approached me and asked if I would like to edit an anthology. And I said, well, sure. And I've been mulling over this idea of ancestry and stories with roots and horror with history and roots, whether that be personal or specific to a location or family background. And again, because I do a lot of traveling around England and I'm fascinated by local history and local lore and folklore and archaeology and all that good stuff, I wanted a book that explored that. And so Roots of My Fears is going to be a collection of an anthology collection of stories from different authors, where the thrust of each story will be some interpretation of roots and stories with roots. So whether it's leaning into personal genealogy or personal traditions or family stories that have been handed down over the generations, or something that came from perhaps near where the author grew up, something that grounds them and roots them into the story. So I'm very excited. I've got, I haven't finished announcing the table of contents yet, but this is a very good time to explain why. We have got authors like Nuzo Ono, Gabino Iglesias, V. Castro, Ai Jiang, Nadia El Fassi, Usman T. Malik. I've got a long list, Erica T. Worth, long list of amazing writers who are contributing stories. But what I'm also going to do, and because I am cognizant that anthologies sometimes do feel a little bit like a popularity contest, I've never been a big fan of that. However, budgetary constraints mean that you sometimes as an editor need to present a book that's marketable, but I'd like to do that in a way which also hopefully opens up a slot for a previously sort of unknown author to be able to come forward and submit a story. So, and by unknown, I just mean not somebody on the invitation list for the TOCs that we're currently seeing. So I'm hoping to open up very shortly to submissions for that anthology. It will be a limited submission window, mostly because I know that there will be a lot of submissions. I'm only one person and I can only do so much slush reading. But I would like to invite submissions from people that perhaps haven't had a shot at a TOC with a traditional publisher as of yet. I'm excited about that. That's coming out in 2025. Oh, we've got Adam Neville as well, Ramsey Campbell, Hayley Piper. It's a lovely list of authors. So I hope it's something a little bit different to what you may have seen on the shelves thus far.
That sounds great. That sounds like a really nice little project, bit different, like you say. I look forward to that.
Thank you, yeah.
And obviously that leads into the closing questions, and the first of which is, you know, do you have a book that you've read recently in the past, whenever, that you'd like to recommend for my listeners?
I mean, I'm going to go back to Annihilation, actually. I talk about it all the bloody time. It's very boring, very repetitive, Gemma, but it is, not only is it one of my favourite books, but it is a book that is remote and lonely and isolated and cut off location with a limited cast of characters, female-led, and there is a monumental structure. In fact, there's two monumental structures in the novel. There's the inverted tower, those who've read it will know, and then there is the lighthouse as well, which is a very deliberate mirror of the two. I am obsessed and fascinated by the mythology that Vandermeer's kind of created in that world, and I think it's quite a good companion read. It's vastly superior novel to mine, I'm under no illusions, but it's a very there are some similar themes running throughout it, like who can you trust, the psychology of trust, identity, breaking down of identity, mimicry and clones and all of that stuff. It's very influential on me, that novel.
I want to love it, but I just feel like I'm not smart enough for it.
It's
too slippery. It slips away from me like oily water between my fingers. I mean, I know it's kind of the point, but
right,
just like,
yeah.
We were saying before about how I was kind of saying, why do people always reject ambiguity? But with that book, it's too ambiguous for me. I'm just like, oh, but what's, give me some answers. It baffles me. I can tell it's amazing. I just don't feel the love.
I would say it's worth a reread because a lot of those answers are there. They're just sort of buried and hidden. And there's so much sumptuous imagery that's so weird that you don't realise necessarily what's happening under it. It is a smart book, but the answers are there. They're just kind of hidden.
Okay.
which I appreciate. I always find something new and every time I reread it. So
what I will say, and this is a recommendation to you as well, Jo, because I think you'd like this book. There's a book that I had on the show late last year by Fiona Barnett, who is a British author, and it's called The Dark Between the Trees.
Okay.
And I described it as a sort of British Annihilation.
Right.
And when I describe it now, it's going to sound really derivative, and it's not at all. I think my comparison was a bit of a surprise to Fiona. But the premise is basically these four women who are led by this quite sinister academic,
right,
and the rest are kind of research students, and one's like a park warden. They go into this isolated bit of forest in the north of England, and things get wiggy and really odd. And like,
did you just say wiggy?
Yeah, it gets wiggy. Yeah, and like you were saying before, about you like stories that are circular, that kind of is it Ouroboros? Ouroboros? I don't know how you say it.
The snake that eats its own tail.
Yeah, that structure, and it's all of that, and it's kind of like a really weird Northern English version of the Vandermeer stuff, and I think you'd like it a lot.
I'd love that. That sounds right up my street.
Yeah, it's worth, listeners, it's worth reading, and Fiona was great on the show, so I recommend that as a companion piece to the companion piece.
Amazing.
That Gemma just mentioned. Yeah.
There's also two movies that sort of fit in with this theme. They're both Lighthouse movies. One is The Lighthouse, which I challenged Neil to watch before the interview, and I don't think he did because he summarized it as just two men in a tower wanking.
And seagulls.
There's more to it than that. But there's also another kind of version of that movie, which I think it's got Gerard Butler in it, and it's called Cold Skin. And it's a similar premise. It's two men in a tower with something else problematic happening. But I don't know. There's so many, and yet there aren't enough tower structure novels and films. So keep writing them, people, because I will read them and enjoy them.
mm-hmm. We'll let you go. And the last question, with you, Gemma, you're so kind of raw and open in how you answer questions that it always feels redundant to ask you this final question because you've probably already covered it anyway. But I'm going to do it. What truly scares you?
Well, I guess at the moment, it's probably this notion of identity and not really truly knowing oneself or what one is capable of. In the past, I've been mostly scared of other people and how they can act and the impact that has on your life. But I think as I grow into my 40s, as I become increasingly more aware of my own capabilities or lack thereof, my relationship with my body changes, with the people around me, as my son grows up and our relationship changes, my friendships are changing, the things that I write about and think about, and probably also I have been changed a little by the pandemic, as we've said. I think what scares me is this recurring theme of perhaps I don't really know myself as well as I thought I did a couple of years ago. Okay. And how do I get back in touch with myself? And there is a general feeling for me personally at the moment of being rather dislocated, which comes out, I think, in a lot of my fiction, like I said, and I tend to write things where people go far away from anybody else and experience stuff. I'm constantly trying to get away, but from what, I don't know. So I think I am perhaps frightened of not knowing myself, not understanding my own identity as well as I might in order to kind of flourish and grow. And this building sense of loneliness that I have as creative, maybe working at home all day long and creating fantasy worlds doesn't really help with that. But I do have quite an active social life. I'm around people a lot, but I still always feel like the stranger in a room crowded full of people. And I'd like to understand more about why that is. And it frightens me that I don't understand that and why I'm like that yet. So I'm going to say my biggest fear at the moment is not knowing myself, but not understanding why I don't know myself better at 41 years old. I think, again, it's why a lot of people hit their 40s and have a massive midlife crisis and go out and buy a sports car. My version of it is writing books that never really get to the bottom of anything.
So, but it's the journey, right? Like, I don't know whether you've been aware of the thing, but you finished off the final question with you saying you don't understand yourself. And at every point in this conversation, you've talked about how this book, The Folly, has been one of many attempts to make sense of a feeling you have. So maybe that's sure. just you. Maybe that's what your creative life is. It's an endless search to untangle your own inner intricacies.
Yeah, I like that. A quest, an inner quest.
Yeah. It just happens to be entertaining for the rest of us. So, yeah. Well, let's end it there because once again, we've talked for a bit about a book and then used this as a platform to just delve into our own neuroses.
I mean, we desperately need therapists, Neil. Let's face it. Yeah. We should short that shit out.
But this is cheaper, right? And we can make people listen to it.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, but anyway, listeners, The Folly is out today. I read it inside 24 hours because it's just a lovely little, I think I described it on Twitter as a nice little sharp stiletto of a story or something like that.
I like that, yeah.
And it's out now. Well, it's out now for you lucky Americans with your Thanksgiving and your holidays, and us Brits have to wait for a bit, but you can all read it soon. And Gemma Amore, thank you as ever for talking scared.
Thank you for having me back. I've had a very illuminating time as ever.
It's always great talking to Gemma because she's as open about her faulty components as I am. And it's especially interesting to hear someone genuinely working out the meaning of their own books in the moment. Because I'm like that. I think with my pen or with my voice. I rarely, if ever, know what I think about anything until I get into it with someone. And that's often the case on this show with the books. But Gemma is brave enough to write fiction that's clearly rooted in her own thoughts and her experiences and her uncertainties, and then comes to an interview with an open mind about her work and what it means about her and for her. And I love that because it makes for an invigorating, slightly white-knuckle interview experience, and that's always more fun. And The Folly is an enigma because What I expected to be like a simple ghost story about a cursed tower turned out to be a short, sharp scalpel of a book that dissects the notion of identity, of family, parenthood, childhood. It even turns on its head the very meaning of the word possession. I mean, those final pages, they are a really disarming sleight of hand trick. And though I'm still not entirely sure about what my conclusions are, and though I'd have loved this book to be longer and to dig further into the local history of this tower and its weirdness, I really enjoyed this as a tight, compact, uncomfortable, single-sitting reading experience. And if nothing else, it'll definitely make you want to go to an Airbnb in a Cornish coastal tower. I mean, you'd take the ghost for the views, trust me, and the isolation. Think of the books you could read. I want to say two things before I outstay my welcome. First, Gemma briefly mentioned a film about someone that she called Amber Rose. It's the film about reincarnation, we think, starring Anthony Hopkins, possibly. It's actually Audrey Rose from 1977, though I imagine Amber Rose could have plenty of material for a horror movie of her own if asked about Kanye. Second, Gemma also mentioned early in the conversation that her next book is going to be set in the Fens of East Anglia, in the area where she grew up, and I stupidly forgot to go back and ask about that, and I'm annoyed at myself. But it's such an evocative landscape that I do want to recommend another book set there, one of the absolute top-tier titles ever featured on Talking Scared, The Last Thing to Burn by Will Dean. Came out all the way back at the very start of 2021, which feels like a long time ago now. It's a story of tawdry crime and cruel imprisonment, both within a house and within a landscape. It makes the Fens a horror setting all of their own. It's a masterpiece. Go read it immediately. Ask for it for Christmas and listen to episode 21 when Will talked to me about it. Oh, and also, The Woman in Black by Susan Hill is set in a similar part of the country, so read or watch that too. As ever, I'd love you to get in touch about anything, as long as it's nice. I'm far too overworked to deal with not nice, so don't bother. Find me on social media, I mean pretty much all of them at this point. I'm at TalkScaredPod on all platforms, or email me at TalkingScaredPod@gmail.com. And please, follow me on Threads or Instagram if you're on there, because I'm really trying to grow my Insta community. If you can leave a review on Apple or Spotify, please, please do. I'll love you forever. And to reiterate, if you want loads of extra listening and to support the show with some small amount of your own money, the Patreon is ready for you at patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. And just thank you, as ever, for that. I'm back next week with a big one. An author who's written a genuine, bona fide, true classic of contemporary horror. It's Michelle Paver. And we're going to kick off a winter of adventure horror with a close look at her twin novels, Dark Matter and Thin Air. Get your heaviest coat ready. Until then, give yourself a break because we're all tired. Hunker down and don't be afraid to get to know yourself. Read good books and remember, it's good to be scared.